Okay, so for people, I haven't met officially or not officially, I'm Yulu, postdoc at Stanford. So this is the topic I'm going to talk about, stellar mass, cold gas mass, and feedback in low mass halos. I chose this topic just to make a better connection with the talks we had in the past from Tom the week before last and Andre's talk last week. And hopefully also some general interests. I feel low mass halos are interesting, in particular understanding feedback is because we know the cooling time scale for those small halos are very short. The cooling time scale is generally shorter than Hubble time scale. So then from there, you figure out in order to have CDN cosmology to work and to explain the galaxy population, you need a strong feedback in order to just get rid of small galaxies. You don't observe those galaxies, so although halos are there, they are not galaxies. That's by assuming all the baryons, the cosmic fraction of baryons can collapse into those halos. So then the question is how we model this. There are galaxy formation models, in particular semi-analytical models. A lot of models claim they can solve this problem, or they can demonstrate by doing some magic feedback, you can explain certain observational data. So then let me just review briefly how this type of models really work. So first you assume a small halos of four, and then you put a baryon into the halos just by this constant fraction, which is a cosmic baryon fraction. Then you start from there and allow gas to cool. And when gas cools, it forms stars and generates outflow when you have star formation. Then from there, you figure out all these feedback processes you assume there are associated with star formation. No matter what form of feedback you are talking about, either it's supernova type 2 or some other types of feedback, stellar wind or radiation pressure, all these processes are associated with star formation. And from there, we have observations constraining stellar mass, like luminosity functions. So these are sources of this type of feedback, because as I said, all the processes you are considering in this framework are associated with star formation. So there you have some control on the sources. On the other side, you have a measurement of cold gas of these galaxies. So these are the residuals. When you form stars, you use a fraction of cold gas. And also when you launch outflow, you have some cold gas left there. So when you constrain stellar mass and cold gas mass, you hope you learn something about feedback. Then the question now is, the first question is, can this type of models really explain existing data? Luminosity function and the H1 mass function by ratio zero. The other question is, if this type of models really work, then whether we can learn something from such so-called successful models. I can tell you answers right here, because this is supposed to be a short talk, and busy people like Tommaso can run away, because you already get the answer. The answer is, this family of model can certainly explain this data, but you'll find the energy is very marginal if you think the sources are from supernova type 2. And also, you'll find the feedback has to be very strong in terms of launching outflow. from this exercise.
What do you mean with the energy from supernova is marginal? You mean it's marginal, it's just enough? Is that what you're trying to say?
Just enough.
Just enough.
Just enough. Assuming normal initial mass function.
Right. So you're saying basically you need to tap in about close to 100% of the supernova energy.
Yeah, exactly. The third thing I learned is the mass functions at the faint end actually can put a very strong constraint on how this supernova feedback or whatever type of star formation feedback works under this model family. So then here, let me spend one slide to talk a little bit briefly about the approach I'm taking. So here I take a semi-analytical model. I construct a semi-analytical model, which is very similar to any other semi-analytical models from other groups. And so there we have merger trees and all the necessary data tables there, and read all this information in and walk down the tree, assume radiative feedback of the halo gas, and consider whether the halos merge, whether galaxies merge. If galaxies don't merge, then you have star formation in quiescent phase. If you have galaxy-galaxy merger, then you that galaxy is in starburst phase. For different phases, you have different recipes to predict a star formation. When you have star formation, you predict how supernova feedback works. You either reheat the ISM into halo hot gas phase, or you just eject the ISM out of the halo, or you dump some extra energy into hot halo gas so that a fraction of hot halo gas can go away from the halos. All these processes are parameterized, and you use a bunch of parameters to control these processes. My feeling, although a lot of people feels this is so-called a theory, galaxy formation theory, but actually I personally don't feel so. I don't feel this is theory, because in my mind, I feel theory is first, you need to make an explicit assumption. And second, you need to make direct prediction before you see the data. If you tune your parameters after you see the data, that is no longer a theory. I name this type of work or practice inference. So you do inference. So this approach is still valid, but you shouldn't name this a theory. It's inference. So then I feel a useful approach to do this type of inference is Bayesian inference. Because here we only roughly know, under a certain assumption, you only roughly know about the range of the parameters. You don't know which value you should take for most of the parameters.
So it's the fact that people don't know the mass of the Higgs, the fact that the model is not a theoretical model. Okay, we can move on.
Yeah. Let's talk about this. This I don't think it is clear.
But the Higgs is theory, the mass is influence.
Yeah. But basically, you, I always feel so. It's difficult to rule out any semi-analytical models simply because they don't make a clear point about which part of the model is the part you want to test, which other parts are the assumptions. So you can always, when you find that the model fails, you can always say, oh, some other parts of the model need to be calibrated, which is difficult to follow. Okay, come back to this Bayesian framework. So then you ask the question, what's the probability to, under certain assumption or the model family, in which range of the parameter space you can reasonably explain the data, and what's the how likely the model is supported by certain data? You can do this type of inference to get a model parameter estimation. And also you can do a certain type of model selection when you have multiple choices. So then my approach is, first I have these semantical models, and I generate a lot of random numbers to sample these posterior distributions. Tom doesn't like random numbers, but this is basically what I do every day. generate random numbers and hope some of the random numbers can tell me something about the universe. So basically you run this loop, which is a nightmare, because semantical models runs relatively slowly compared to other type of applications. But when you have a big computer, you choose your favorite model family, you tune your MCMC algorithm, you hope after several weeks you get something. So these are the data sets I'm using for this talk. On this side, we have K-band luminosity function from Bell et al. 2003. Two mass data. The other side is Zhuang et al. 2003, same year. This is from HAPAS survey. There are updated version of H1 mass functions, but actually the changes, in particular the finhand, actually is not that big. When you compare updated H1 HAPAS data or newer alpha survey data. The finhand for the H1 mass function is about 1.3 or 1.37, something around there. But for K-band luminosity function, actually I feel there might be a larger uncertainty. For this specific data set I'm using, 2003 Bell et al., the finhand slope is very, very flat. It's 0.88, although there is a turnover part, but this only occurs at very faint regime. Actually, a lot of constraint is not from there, from the exercise I'm going to tell you. But there are some other measurements, projects. For example, Huang et al., they got a very steep finhand. So there is just better to have this in your mind. There might be some uncertainties. But anyway, for this inference, I'm going to tell you, is from Bell et al., 2003, very flat thing. Okay, so here this is what I get for the posterior distribution. These are 16 free parameters. Including parameters for star formation, for supernova feedback, all types of supernova feedback, no matter it's reheating or ejection or whatever wind. It's very general model family. And also some parameters for merger, for gas reincorporation, a lot of other things. So you can find these are marginalized posterior distribution. But by the way, this is a preliminary. It's not converged yet. But I don't think the overall situation will, qualitative conclusion will change when I have converged version. But anyway, you'll find that some of the parameters are better constrained than others. Some parameters are not constrained at all.
In terms of your feedback, do you throw out gas and it never comes back, or do you have some?
Okay, yes, that's a free parameter. You launch outflow, and you parameterize reincorporation in terms of halo dynamical timescale. That's a free parameter.
Okay.
That parameter actually is constrained, but weakly. So you prefer, from this exercise, you'll find you prefer the model to have very slow reincorporation. Basically, whatever you launched just never comes back. The other side, I show the reproduced K-band luminosity function and H1 mass function by marginalizing over the posterior distribution function.
Do you use your prior?
Okay, the prior, this is a good question. Actually, I struggle with prior a lot. But finally, I feel this doesn't really help because it's very difficult to choose a physical word informative prior for semantical models. As I said, this is not a theory. It's very difficult. So literally, I choose a flat prior. Although some parameters are parameterized in terms of logarithmic scale. So there it is.
But they are flat priors over finite range.
Yes,
always.
Right, always.
And sometimes you have uniform prior logarithm and sometimes uniform parameter.
Yeah.
Is this because sometimes you think you know the order of magnitude and sometimes you think you don't know?
Exactly. For example, later I will.
So Jeffrey's prior when you know.
Yes.
It looks like you have very little covariance between most of your variables.
But some dimensions you see very strong covariance.
And the alpha and the beta parameters.
Yeah, those are. Actually, those are essential parameters I will talk about in this talk.
The other question is the range in masses or the velocities of which you fit, because we think that it's different physics in different scales. So
that's true, but this is what semiotical model people do, right? So you hope
but
you
say supernova feedback that might not work for massive galaxies.
Oh, that's because in SAM you don't believe some supernova feedback works for massive galaxies. You have some other physics built in, which is also represented by some.
So you have AGM.
Yeah, I have. Yeah, it's not a full AGM model.
Right.
It's later I will also talk about.
Yes, but just have a comment. Some of your posteriors histogram seems to be cut. Is that?
Yeah.
Or is that the edge of the
I would say most of them, those situations happens because of true physics.
It's not because your prior is not large enough?
Well,
the efficiency
can only go
only
one.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Something like that.
Given that the basic shape of the function is given by a halo mass function, and you're just modifying that a little bit for this prior faint end, isn't this large number of parameters a bit ambitious? Because they're not really describing the shape of that function.
Right, actually, there are two things.
Using minor perturbations on that shape.
Yeah, there are two things you can change. One is underlying halo mass function you can change. The other one is whether the data is certain. Right? By changing halo mass function, certainly they will change. But the overall shape of this posterior won't change dramatically. It really depends on which part you want to change, basically.
I guess what Martin was saying is that if you try with fewer parameters and add more until the evidence required that you could do that, or did you have a preconception of what the parameters should be explored only this set of parameters? Because when you say
so, whether there is you are changing the model family. Right.
Yeah.
We do this, but this will not be presented.
And the nice thing about this is that you do it in the parameter of models that claim to be physical in terms of you describe physical processes like star formation, feedback, etc. So you can also go to something like abundance matching, where basically you can get a much better fit with fewer parameters.
Right, but maybe it turns out that you don't need some parameters.
Yeah, that can be answered by looking at the result. Some of the parameters are not constrained. That means those are Newton's parameter for these data sets. But it doesn't mean these parameters are not useful or not meaningful, because some other data sets may constrain that part.
Perhaps you can walk us just through a couple, just as an example.
Yeah, actually, this is what I'm going to do. Okay, one key thing here I want to point out is two key feedback parameters are tightly constrained. One is the parameter describing AGN feedback. So this tells you above a certain halo mass scale, all the radiative cooling of Hall halo gas has to be turned off. Otherwise, you produce luminosity function doesn't look like what we observed, so which is around the 10 to 12 solar mass halo. The other parameters The other parameter is the parameter controlling ejection. So there, below certain value of the halo circular velocity, all the reheated ISM need to leave the halo and almost never come back. So this halo circular velocity scale is constrained to 160 kilometers per second, which actually is very similar to the value other semi-level model use. Actually, I was surprised, but this only demonstrates how clever they are. This is completely independent of redshift. I try not to introduce explicit redshift dependence. I try to pretend to say all these parameterized models are physics. The other interesting plot for this marginalized posterior is something related with another two feedback parameters. So these are parameters for the loading factor. Just to remind you how people do mass loading for supernova or stellar star formation feedback in semi-level models. So when you have a certain mass formed in this time step, then you launch a certain amount of wind. And this is called the loading factor. In order to fit, to obtain good fit to some certain observations, people invented to have this circular velocity dependence, just to say this may contain some physics. But the dependence, the power index, and the normalization are free parameters. So these are something we want to infer from those observational data. So what I plotted here, the x-axis is the normalization logarithmic. The other axis is the power index. So you find your model is constrained to this very elongated region. This is, again, a Santa banana. I feel this is interesting because you find you need always to have a combination of these two parameters in order to obtain good fit to K-band luminosity function and H1 mass function. No anywhere else. This is marginalized over other dimensions. Okay.
So is it roughly the direction of constant mass probing, or what is?
This is not really. I put two lines. Let me finish these two lines. Okay. This is how you do in a SAM to launch the outflow. But there are some certain physical constraints to this type of models. One very obvious thing is you have energy limitation. So because you use all the star formation activity to power feedback, then you know the star formation history. For every unit of stellar mass formed, you have only a fraction of mass can form a supernova type 2 or whatever. And this is this depends on initial mass function. And for every supernova type 2, you have a certain amount of energy output. And you use some efficiency parameter to say, OK, this amount of energy is available to do any type of feedback. And for this outflow, you use this amount of energy. Then you say how much mass I want to load. in this outflow. Then that depends on what the circle, what the velocity you want to put for this outflowing gas. So for normal semi-analytical models, people assume this outflow has a velocity proportional to the circular velocity, simply because those two, there are two types of outflow you build in to semi-analytical model. One is you assume the gas is ejected out of the halo. Then of course, the launch velocity has to be higher than escaping velocity of the halo, right? So there you get a velocity constraint. The other way people do this is to do reheating. So you assume the energy put into ASM and the gas is thermalized to the zero temperature. Then of course, this also tells you how much energy you want to use. So then the energy you use has to be smaller than the energy available. Even you assume this, by assuming this efficiency coefficient to be unity, then you get a upper limit for how much mass you can load. So here I just illustrate the dangers of this type of assumption, because by this assumption, you know for lower circular velocity halos, you can load more material simply because the potential is lower for small halos. But this is only -2. If you assume this beta steeper than -2, then at some certain regime, you are going to overuse energy. If you assume this loading factor to have a very flat circular velocity dependence, you may overuse energy on large velocity regime. So then you want to evaluate whether this contour you get is valid in terms of energy. Then I have these two lines just to show for 200 kilometers per second halos, anything on this side overuse energy when you assume.
So you don't include that constraint inside the model.
I don't put this in only after the fact. Yeah, actually I have a separate exercise which does this. That will give you almost the same answer, but won't be the same contour, but the same conclusion. So in this region, you find your overuse energy for massive halos. And this line is drawn for 70 kilometers per second halos. So for those halos, if you want to assume this circular velocity dependence, then what's the maximum loading factor normalization you want to use? Any part in this region are excluded if you assume initial mass function is this number and the efficiency is 1. So you find you can certainly change IMF or dump more energy from some other sources. For example, massive stars, stellar wind, or some other type of.
What are the contours there?
Contours are marginalized posterior. The levels follow the previous one. Tells you a certain fraction of confidence level.
Yeah, but does it mean that we have beta of zero?
No, it does. Yeah. Thank you for pointing this out. Actually, these are only the marginalized posterior distribution. This is only tells you that. Actually, the chi-square or likelihood, you want to say, or goodness of fit, doesn't follow this. The best of the model actually is here, simply because here you have a projection effect.
No, of course, but in the marginalized posterior, you can define the confidence levels in the marginalized posterior. They may not equate to the projection of the overall best fit, but if I were to, neglect all the other parameters and consider all these two, how much would I confer beta of zero?
Okay, if you do that, you'll find it's here. It is here.
So, by interval, is more likely than yellow. How much more likely is yellow in this figure?
Okay, so the yellow band is let me see, roughly 20-30 from the peak. So here is 30% of probability, you end up with these two regions. But actually, the peak of the likelihood is that
the peak of the evidence, because that's where you should look at rather than the peak of the likelihood.
Yeah.
You can look in projection. The peak of the likelihood doesn't necessarily
Because the peak of the likelihood could be off, because of the median also.
Okay, another thing interesting.
So can I just translate your number? So if you're at alpha, R8 is minus 3, then most massive galaxies have beta, don't lose any gas at all.
From this channel of feedback.
So when do they start to lose mass? When is delta MR?
Okay,
delta
certainly.
Star 1?
Okay, it depends. It certainly depends on this beta, right?
Six.
If it's a six, you're asking one is one.
200 over V6 is then minus 3 to the 6. How
much? I couldn't do math right now, but okay. Okay, these stars are the values I found in literature, how other semiotic models assume. And you find a lot of them actually are in this region. Again, prove they are smart people. Some other things are outlier. Some models tend to overuse energy for this standard. But they may assume different initial mass function or things like that.
Shouldn't they have, don't a lot of these models just have the criterion that, in principle, you eject so much energy until, just the criterion you wrote down at the third line, that the energy out is small.
Yeah, you can do that if you assume that, but this is not generally people do. This is me. Yeah, and because, no, not really.
Yeah.
So she does that part only for the hot gas ejection.
Mm-hmm.
So what Munich people do is they first assume, so this is Croton here. Early dilution model is different from Croton at all.
Yeah.
But the recent Munich group is assuming this loading factor to be a constant. So there is no problem for small halos at all, because you only launch a small fraction of mass. Then what they do in the following is, you use this fraction of energy to do reheating. Then they consider the total amount of energy available from here. And then you use 35% of this energy dump into the hot halo gas and push a fraction of a hot halo gas out. So there, so still you need to know this number is still not very low. And another exercise would be interesting is to look at how these regions make predictions. And I have this plot just to compare what Tom showed the other day. This is exactly the same prediction for the star formation. Basically, this is specific star formation rate for halo mass as a function of halo mass, I redshift 4. And this different region in the parameter space give you very different specific star formation rate trend. So that's why I was not surprised when Tom show different models give you all these kind of things. The other thing is you just look at how these regions predict K-band luminosity function. Then you find you need this loading factor to be very steep function of circular velocity in order to obtain very flat part of the K-band luminosity function. Otherwise, you overpredict the slope, if you believe this data.
Doesn't it predict the bottom as well?
the Goldilocks solution is too.
You mean this part?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Or do you just put some AGM in too?
Right.
Right, solve that with AGM.
Yeah. But here we focus on the pinhead. And if you make a prediction, not that far, only to stellar mass, and you plot stellar mass fraction, stellar mass over halo mass for central galaxies as a function of halo mass at ratio zero, and compare what Peter obtained from abundance matching, you find, again, this flat mass loading will over-predict the stellar mass for small halos.
But in the small figures, you expect feedback to be more important than the AGM. Where would you use the AGM model?
Oh, AGM only works, as I demonstrated in the first contour, that only works beyond 10 to 12. So AGM shouldn't work for small halos anyway.
It's a bit confused then why the different feedback models give you different brightness as well.
Oh, Brightness slope. Okay. So here, because this is very steep, right? Very steep. So for massive halos, you don't use much energy at all. So I would say for...
We regulate it with AGM anyway. We don't regulate it with those parameters. Or you
Okay, I would say, don't be confused. Actually, this is not the full yellow part. Yellow part is all the way from here to here.
Okay.
Yeah, so don't be confused about that. Yeah, I should make a separate plot. Maybe that's better. And this is H1 mass function. So they look pretty identical, even you look at a different range of that parameter. So here, what I want to say is how the finhand really behaves can really tells you how the feedback should work. Why is that? Simply because there you have a limited amount of stars there. That tells you you have only limited amount of supernova energy. Then when you want to get this residual, then how you use energy? That's the question. So I think that's pretty much what I want to say for this lunch talk. But anyway, so these are my conclusions. So I feel these feedback processes are very important and can be constrained by this model inference approach. I feel this current framework of SAM, if you assume that what we infer is we need a very strong feedback in low mass halos. This will give you some consequence. For example, you metallicity, how you leave metals in those galaxies. Actually, the plots are not included because I have only limited slice. But what I can tell you is for such models, you always underpredict metals for small halos.
So that's because you say that your constant mass loading doesn't actually work. It's not that.
It's true, right.
But that's in the previous slide, your models with constant mass loading are maybe a bit worse depending on what is the thing and so
on the stuff. Exactly.
Why do you say that strong feedback in low mass halos is needed?
Okay. No. In terms of
what fraction of the available energy do you need, you've got to channel into the
feedback. Right.
But then take out the low mass. Strong feedback is needed. Because the one which is independent of the low mass works maybe slightly worse than with your strong, with your large alpha.
I agree. I make that a conclusion. First, because of this, so you find whatever you assume, no matter how beta you choose, right? You always have this. That tells you below 160 kilometers per second.
That's what you're paying me out of almost.
There's the nightclub theory of galaxies, right? We either have bouncers or velvet ropes. It's a question of whether you throw stuff out or you keep from coming in. And when people try to put these things into simulations, going back to, I don't know, Scaniapo, Thacker, and Davis, they just arbitrarily stuck big winds in little objects. And because it takes about 2 or 3% of the energy to keep stuff from coming in, as to throw it out, when they put winds in the little things, they got much more of an effect from those winds keeping the nearby things from forming.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, like the McMaster folks in their simulations see the same kind of thing. It's right. Just, you know, that factor of 30 in energy is just big.
But that's what I say by this model family. Don't forget the very basic assumption here is to assume the accretion is a baryon fraction. So if you think the feedback can prevent further accretion, then you should build up an alternative model just to demonstrate that. I'm not against that part.
So what do you inference? Part of the inference is using the data. So why did you choose these two specific luminosity functions? Why did you choose only luminosity functions? Unless you think other luminosity functions are wrong, why not use all of them?
Okay. I had another paper use K-band luminosity function only. So this is the further step in, just to bring in a new information into this inference. If you ask about other bands of luminosity function for then
measurements of the same band, other measurements of the same band.
Other measurements of the same band.
There's more than one key band.
Yeah, exactly, right. Then that's what I meant by this plot. Here this beta equals zero model cannot be ruled out if you think the K-band is that steep. So that's why I say the Fintan slope is crucial in understanding the outflow.
Right, but I'm saying you have this big machine. Why don't you use all the data that you have to constrain rather than two subsets of all the data?
But that doesn't necessarily make it better. It's really important. It doesn't make it better. I mean, if you have different data,
it's
just you don't get it right.
More data.
Well, in the past, people used to run a simulation model and browse the data until we found a beneficial ratio and had the right slope.
Exactly. But
in the end, you're not interested in these numbers in the first place. I think most of them are very poor prescription of any physical model. They're just basically a recipe to have a certain effect. So I think the only thing what you will ever do is you can ask one specific question with these models and then use it as a Monte Carlo representation and then look at as much data and see if I can address that particular question. For example, if the removed mass has to be a function of circular velocity.
Right.
And then I should go for all the data that can constrain this particular question. But then I haven't confirmed a simulated model, I haven't fixed any of these parameters that just try to address these questions. And that's the kind of game you can play with these models. But I don't think in the end there will be one model, and we will have a standard model of semi-analytics, and we have 16 standard parameters that basically determine these two, three digits behind the significant digits. It's just a completely wrong approach to go down that route. It's not like in the CMD where you have fundamental numbers that you want to constrain with a certain accuracy. You want to ask questions. So then you really have to understand the data bits by bit and have to bring the data together that can address this particular question.
Right, but
in
this particular question,
don't
you want to include
this particular question is...
If you look at feedback...
Now this K-band luminosity function was the very first thing people had used transitivity simulating models. They realized that you have to do something, what is roughly, gives you his alpha parameters of 2, and that he gets back. That's sort of not astonishing because these people are not completely stupid. So they realize that the two roughly gives you the result, but we're also aware of the fact that that's highly degenerate, that you can make up for this by doing something else, pertaining some of the other parameters. That's exactly what he recovers now.
But if
I think if you really want to address that question, you have now to go slice at a redshift, go to higher redshift, to say, go to different bands, because open system, where you might probably other bands, but you really have to concentrate on one question at a time. Otherwise, I think you're just going in circles.
But you might start ruling out things if you look at more.
Right.
But you have ruled out things. There's not enough energy to do that.
Yeah. This is step one, right? Two reproduces specific observation in this model family. This is, you know, this is what it tells you. I mean, he's looked at many other data constraints. This was one example. Including at other redshifts, including at Elizabeth. Yeah. I told him not to show more than 5 plots.
Do you find the same parameters
fit those different data? Okay. Yeah. We are more ambitious than what I showed today. But the more I'm ambitious, the more frustrated I got. whenever I bring in a new piece of data, I realize that this model doesn't work. I have to work on some other parts, either increasing the dimensionality or change some parts of the model.
You're learning something.
Yeah, I hope.
That's the best thing you've ever hoped to learn. You can actually learn things wrong.
Yeah.
But it is also true that other people using very, very similar parameterization of similar models claim much, much greater success than you. Right? So you're saying you try to add extra things in, like coefficient relation, and maybe gas, fractions, and metallicities?
That's really something I want to understand. I do find a lot of some other successful models. By comparing my model and their model, I feel shame. But
maybe you're honest.
I don't know.
But there is
one important point here. Actually, there is a very fundamental part in semantical model people don't usually talk about, which is about radiative cooling. So there you find all the 16 parameters. None of the 16 parameters has anything with radiative cooling. But
so
there, when you
parameter free because they really capture the physics. That's what it
claims. But there, the assumption that the cooling time is shorter than the cache has cooled catastrophically.
Because that's no longer true.
It's not true. But the people originally set up these models, they came with that mindset, and that's the reason why they didn't parameterize as big. I don't say that's a reasonable thing to do. I just explain why that's not in these models because they will build them with it.
They calculate the cooling radiant,
yeah.
At which the radius of which basically the cooling inside of which the cooling time is the same as the Hubble time. Sometimes people use Hubble time, sometimes dynamical time, sometimes critical time. And then within that radius, they assume that it's cool. And you basically make predictions that for evolution and redshift and halo mass. But then it's parameter free.
False.
Sorry?
I don't believe you.
What is false?
How do you have a parameter free anything?
I don't have it.
How did they?
So people who use these analytical models, their cooling prescription has no free parameters in it.
No free parameters, okay.
But then they go to another simulacrum model, or they write another paper, and then they change the way they prescribe the cooling, and they still don't add free parameters. And they say, no, we only have 5 free parameters. They keep changing the prescription.
Change the function.
Yeah, but that's not free parameters, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
how do you deal with reionization?
Okay, for this specific exercise, I didn't include reionization. Part of the reason is the regime I care about actually is beyond reionization. Of course, that will have some impact because bigger halos are formed from merging small pieces.
Yes.
But I don't think that will be a big problem because so here you see the deviation you see clearly is already beyond 10 to 11 submass halos.
There's also like shielding and not shielding.
Yeah, that's too detailed. I don't understand. So I don't want to model something that I don't understand.
Yeah, would you have any idea what effect that might have on these curves you're showing?
I don't really believe those details can.
The effects would be a very low mass. As soon as you get to higher masses, then you form so many stars that whatever history you had before, which is altered by reionization, is erased.
Okay.
So you vary your mass loading at 200 kilometers per second by a factor of 1,000.
Yeah.
Are there any observations from strings?
Oh, then there must be. Of course, observation can certainly help us something.
So alpha is the mass loading at 200.
But that's mass loading for 200 kilometers.
Yes, or any.
I don't think there's any.
You would say so these values of 10 to minus 3 are completely ruled out.
Let's go back to the beta.
I can see the scale again. So alpha is the value at 200
kilometers per second. 10 to minus 3.
So it goes to 10 minus 3, which is actually your preferred value.
So the problem.
From this inference. But
the problem with measuring alpha is that we always measure lower limits because we never, in the same galaxy, measure the gas in all phases. Okay, but you easily get something from of order one for alpha.
So that's the lower limit. So it means that it can throw away everything.
So that would
be
worth
trying. So you prefer zero.
Right. So you prefer the white part.
Yeah,
you
prefer the white part.
Then.
Yeah.
The white green.
But don't forget. No. Here is very, very steep, right? Here is very steep. So for 10 to 12, 200 kilometers per second is small, but it suddenly.
But we measured it at 200 kilometers per second.
No, we probably measured a little below 200, so you have to.
Right, but that could be used to rule out a substantial part of this plot.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, M82, the rotation speed is probably like 150 or something kilometers a second.
And there you would say alpha is
true. At least for now. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wanted to ask you chose to cast feedback from massive stars completely in terms of an energetic limitation. Would you consider doing it in terms of momentum? Just because then you could add together the mechanical part from supernovae and the luminosity.
That's the part I don't feel is even relevant, because no matter how you load the material, you have to obey this energy conservation.
Whether this
momentum loading or energy loading, it only tells you how you use the energy.
But there's more than your 10 to the 51.
Yeah, there's an order of magnitude more energy in the.
No, but you barely have enough. If you think about the momentum, right, it's a supernova. It's set at like 10,000 kilometers per second.
My point is that in the radiation field, there's an order of magnitude more energy than there is in the
energy. Right.
But we see
the supernova. The momentum divided by c, and it's not much momentum. So the momentum in the radiation is the energy divided by c.
Yeah.
The momentum in the winds of the supernova are something like the energy divided by 10,000 kilometers per second or 1,000 kilometers per second. So you're losing relative to energy once you get the momentum. It's basically just it's effectively like saying as soon as supernovae go off, they go directly into snowplow phase, because that's momentum conservation.
Sure.
And if that happened, nothing would go anywhere. That's efficient cooling. And you're basically turning the cooling off here because you want to use energy rather than momentum. Momentum's a big loser.
I'm not following that.
So it's basically, so the momentum, of course, is your energy divided by the speed that you launch things with. And since the speed that you're launching with things with, in any case, either photons or supernovae, is much greater than 200 kilometers per second, you're losing by that ratio of the launch speed to 200 kilometers per second, if you consider momentum. So the moment you cool, of course, cooling conserves momentum, but cooling loses energy. And that's just the statement that any cooling and you're dead here is a statement that momentum is a loser. You've got to pretend you're using all the energy without cooling.
But it would have seemed like you could also lose energy to keep the momentum.
You do keep the momentum, but the problem is that the momentum you have, again, but you, because you lose energy.
In terms of momentum driving, where are you losing energy?
If I have a certain amount of momentum, right, the momentum I have, if I look at the energy, I basically sort of say, then I get m dot times v escape squared. That's my basic equation. But if I'm going to use momentum, then I have m dot v escape, right? And now the problem is that this momentum is now my original loading of the wind, so it's something like, you know, the stars that are forming, times the velocity of the wind, right?
So momentum,
whereas here, momentum, this energy was m times the velocity of the wind squared. So you can see that when you then look to see what momentum can do, you've lost this power of v escape over v wind.
So momentum there is L over C. Why is
it? Okay, so for the radiation, sure. If it's L over C, right, then that's energy over C, right? And energy over C is a lot worse than energy over v escape, right? You're really losing big. Here you're losing, again, here the launch speed, the effective wind speed of the photons is C. So now I'm losing by V escape over C rather than V escape over 10,000 kilometers per second. It's just the fact that you know, I do best with the supernovae if I leave it adiabatic, or, you know, I mean, like, it's not even assumed adiabatic, it's constant energy here, right? As soon as I cool, I lose the energy that's driving the bubble, but I conserve the momentum. And so, cooling is the enemy here, and that's the reason why cooling is the enemy.
But it's not simple, because basically momentum driven is always parameterized basically with a beta of 1, whereas energy driven is basically driven with a beta of 2.
Oh, right.
If beta of one says
you've got to have an unrealistic efficiency.
That's all.
Beta of two says that your efficiency wasn't one.
That's just the lane time scaling. I think if you want to have a gradient relativity, it's perfectly right. L over C is not enough. Everybody finds that L over C, you need a couple of times of it. So you have to take the radiative force to drive it much larger than escape velocity, thermalize it, and then drive a thermally driven wind. And then you might use the scaling of a radiative driven wind, that's just a different power of V, but energetically it's perfectly right. If you basically just take it over C, it's not enough.
But at least four or five times,
that means you have to basically thermalize energy before you get to the escape speed.
But that's exactly what they try to do with this radiation feedback, where they try to make sure that the moment the supernova goes off, it doesn't have to do any work against the molecular, dense molecular gas, directly couples to the hot gas, and therefore I don't go through the cooling catastrophe problem, and I can actually I can actually funnel the L over C into my thermalization.
The simulations, they just take a different scaling and put more than L over C in terms of energy. That's what they do. Otherwise, it doesn't work.
It's a loser. It's like, you know, it's much more.
That might be physically impossible. If you take an AGM, so we know that these have the broad absorption line winds from the disk. These are probably radiative capability, but they're coming out at 10,000 kilometers a second, 7,000 kilometers a second. If you will not be able to drive that wind radiatively out to the escape speed by just taking the velocity down, you have to thermalize it before and start a thermally driven wind from a hot bubble. Then you can make it energetically, but not radiative driven all the way. It just doesn't work energetically.
I agree. But I'm confused now, because what Lou is saying, we can have beta being minus, beta being 2, 1, 0, that's all allowed, and even be up to 6. 0, 1, 2 is certainly allowed, and you always get values in the range for alpha about unity.
For 6, you obviously didn't get alpha.
Yeah.
We're talking about energy, momentum, or this constant wind mode, which are beta 1, 0, and 2.
But if you look at that, I mean, isn't this line basically, this line is basically making this quantity a few at 160 kilometers per second, right?
Yeah. Red line.
This is red line.
This line is red line. basically makes that a few at 160 kilometers per second, which is where he needs it to be a few, which just sort of says that again, like at 160 kilometers per second,
well, if you assume beta one,
you need much higher efficiency than if you assume beta.
No, log alpha, it's log alpha. You want to be at zero.
Pardon?
Why are you pointing at alpha, log alpha one?
I was pointing to beta one.
Beta of 1,
yeah, what's
beta of 1 is log alpha 1. You don't want log alpha 1. What do you want log alpha 1? You want alpha 1, log alpha 0.
You want alpha to be a few at 160 kilometers per second. And I think that's probably what this line is alpha is a few at 160 kilometers per second.
The line is exclusive.
Yeah, this is the energy that...
Above the line, you over lose your energy. As long as you're below the line, you're fine.
As long as you're below the line, below the line at some velocity. The red line
so below the one, you still have the velocity, either escaping velocity or circular velocity of the halo, so that you can really do this type of work.
So can you go over where the red line and the green line are?
Okay, the green line is, okay, you know the energy available, right? Mm-hmm. And you take 200 kilometers per second.
Okay.
You ask the maximum number for alpha.
Okay.
You find it here.
So that's energy conservation.
Yeah.
As opposed to so one is not momentum conservation. It's momentum conservation pretending that the energy is fixed at 200 kilometers per second, not between wing launch and wing. That's where you lose.
There's confusion. When people do momentum and wind, you still have to do energy conservation. So you will say, not just momentum conservation. When people, some people, when they talk about momentum-driven winds, what they basically mean is a wind that scales with, according to the upper equation there, with beta being one. That's what some people call momentum-driven winds. That's how I look at it. And that, of course, that still has to abide the energy criterion. But that comes from an idea that, on both sides, you get momentum conserved.
Yeah. If you take that model, basically, here you...
You've got to add the wind launch.
Yes.
When you started conserving momentum, as opposed to if you start conserving momentum at 200 kilometers per second, then it's not much difference. But if you start conserving momentum at the wind launch, then it's...
But that's what I don't understand with the model you want to advocate, the one with beta being zero. Okay? And you're saying no, but that's actually in agreement with the data because the actual mass loading parameters of order, few. But what are the velocities of the wings of big momentum? If you look at M82, what's the velocity of the wind?
Somewhere in the
200
to 600 kilometers.
And then do you see variations of that? It's bubble in the galaxy, it's always at the order?
You always see cool gaps with the mean Doppler shift of about 200. But then there are rings to the line flow line, up to 600-700 kilometers per second. The question is how you translate that line profile into a model for physical density and velocity.
Because it corresponds among the initial stuff, there's not much in the wind.
Exactly. Well, it may be the low column density part of the wind that's a high velocity. And
so there are no observational indications that there is any scaling of a wind velocity with similar parameters?
So if you have several decades in either star formation rate or stellar mass, you will see the wind speeds climb, increasing the star formation. But it's a very slow climb. If you have a decade or decade and a half baseline in star formation rate or stellar mass, it will look essentially independent.
But isn't part of that if I had a wind that had a very high velocity, then the invariable shocks put the gas in the state where I just don't have legal lines to see it.
Okay.
If I have a wind with too low a velocity, then the shocks just cause it to cool and stall. Because the cooling is so efficient at 100 kilometers per second. So 200 kilometers per second is probably a sweet spot just to see wind speed. Because you're getting kind of close to the Bremsstrahlung part of the cooling curve, but still in a place where you're not completely free-free. You've got some lungs, and so you get velocity.
I think all this freedom that we have, I mean, it opens out if we could just work out at what rate is the material streaming away. It's observationally, if we could really nail that down, then we string this stuff.
Which phase do you want to measure it in?
If you look at the...
Do you want to measure coronal gas, or warm ionized gas, or cold neutral gas?
The stuff that's being ejected.
Which place do we look?
I don't know what temperature that stuff is being ejected at.
So that's another issue, right? If you make this gas very hot as it's flowing out, your energy constraint becomes even worse. It's not only you have to remove the gas, but you have to make it very hot as well.
Can I just ask, generally, or more for the discussion, maybe the whole posterior distribution, so when you plot that, very few of the parameters seem to be constrained at all. Can I get you to talk a little bit more about it? I mean, in the sense that here we've got this very complicated model, and then when in your plot, it looks like I didn't need any, those two you need, and the escape velocity. Are there others that are actually of use?
For example, Hall-fast satellite galaxies merging to centrals, that's also constrained. But there is a fair amount of degeneracy between that planet and the AGN.
What about the star function parameterization? Isn't just star function parameterization by itself enough to just tune in so that you can?
Actually, we found by comparing this posterior with the previous one we ran, constrained by K-band luminosity function, we find that the star formation parameters are much better constrained. Simply because here you have only a limited amount of cold gas sitting there, so then that parameter is constrained. For the previous run, when we only used K-band luminosity function, because you have freedom to have more or less cold gas, then the star formation parameters can also change correspondingly. So I do find the star formation parameters are better constrained for these exercises. But some other parameters, for example, those ones for star formation in starburst events, those are poorly constrained. That may be because starburst phase is more important for high Z dynamics. For low Z data,
presumably, if you put something like the star formation rate of the universe or something like this, you will take care of it. So I guess the idea here is that they build a model not just to explain these two observables, but they want to explain eventually more observables.
Yeah, I just bring it up though because I know a little bit, sort of, as soon as you try any other redshift, usually don't get solutions.
You showed the star formation rates.
In that sense, much worse, not only just because with two constraints, you didn't need almost any other parameters. Given you have all of those, you still actually can't fit the data.
That's great. But interesting though, because you didn't know beforehand, you didn't know before you ran the chain that you couldn't constrain those parameters. Right, and so it does tell you something interesting.
Oh, exactly.
To have those.
Yeah. I'm saying those plots are awesome.
Say, oh, maybe I don't need those after all.
Yeah, don't get the sign wrong. I find this very illuminating. I mean, you sort of look at this and then you say, okay.
I need my learning.
Why haven't we used it before?
1700. 1700.
Oh, yeah,
computers
are
computing power.
Yeah.